Hello, everybody. This is Dolores Cannon again with the Metaphysical Hour. I apologize for starting late. It seems like everything electronical is acting up again. This has been one of those days, but what do you expect? Mercury is retrograde now. And when Mercury goes retrograde, they said a lot of things go wrong, and we kind of get used to it. But they were late calling, and then my guest is at a hotel, and they were trying to call there, and it was busy. So, you know, best laid plans anyway. But I was out of town last week. I was doing my class in Atlanta. And so they were playing the shows out of the archives. But tonight I do have a live guest, and he's one of the authors that I have published. And his name is Ron Chapman, and he has written the book called Seeing True, and that's the one that my company has published. But we're going to be talking to him for the rest of the time. So I apologize for those of you that are trying to get on, and maybe you thought there wasn't any show tonight. But we're here. Hang with us anyway. Okay, Ron, are you there?
I sure am, Dolores. Thank you.
Okay. That's what I said. You know, when Mercury goes retrograde, everybody has a lot of problems, if you know anything about astrology.
Absolutely. And my life this week has been a confirmation of that.
Yeah, because every time that happens, and we were having a lot of things this last week, and I said, Mercury must be retrograde because everything is haywire. So anyway, we can blame it on that if nothing else.
Convenient.
But we've had problems before with the radio station. Sometimes the telephone wires and everything, the computers get messed up, and we have all kinds of weird things happening. But anyway, we got you now, and we're going to go clear through till right before 8 o'clock.
Okay.
All right. Well, Ron, why don't you tell us first about your background? Because
okay.
Ron is a motivational speaker, and you do talks everywhere, don't you?
I do seem to get around. I have a couple of core practices. One of them is the motivational inspirational speaking, which has kind of taken me all over the place. I'm one of 59 accredited speakers worldwide with Toastmasters International, and so I get a chance to practice my trade in that regard. But I also have an organization development and personal professional development consulting practice, a company called Magnetic North LLC, and I do quite a bit of work currently with chronic disease organizations like the Centers for Disease Control, and have been doing quite a bit of one-on-one work with a lot of people the past, I guess 15 years. And behind the background behind all that, Dolores, as you well know, is that I have a spiritual practice that I don't advertise a lot, but it is central to all that other work that I do, even if I don't talk about it.
Okay, well, that's what I wanted to know. Tell everybody how you got started on all this, you know, how it all began.
Sure. Well, that was almost 25 years ago, and I was having sort of an ordinary American life, and it fell apart on me. Everything
what
that
is
I thought.
Ordinary, though.
What's that?
I said, what is ordinary?
Oh, well, you know, that sort of conventional American working a job and trying to advance a career and married and had a nice house and all those sorts of things. And in the midst of all that, it just literally fell apart. And what ended up happening out of all of that, and it was related to an alcohol problem, and what ended up happening with all that is it caused me to take a good hard look at what I thought I believed. And the result of taking a good hard look at that was that I found myself in a spiritual practice that has continued to evolve over the years through all sorts of things I could have never predicted, but I guess that's a that's probably everybody's spiritual path story, I suppose, Dolores. And
you know, I have found, too, that sometimes if we are going the wrong way, well, we would consider that wrong, but something will happen to shake you up and turn you around. And it can be drastic.
That is precisely what happened to me. The upshot of it all was that my wife of the time, now my ex-wife, left me, and I ended up having to leave the career that I was in at the time and kind of had to start all over again which proved to be good because some of the things that I was, I guess the foundations of that life, quite honestly, just didn't, they really weren't going to work very well, which is probably why I got the shake-up I got.
Yeah, because that's what I always say. They'll hit you up the side of the head.
Yeah,
get your attention one way or the other.
The spiritual 2x4.
Yeah, and it'll get you to go the way you're supposed to go.
Exactly. And so that got my attention and redirected me off to, I went and got some more education, specifically a master's in social work, and the results of all that took me into a broad body of work that I never dreamed. And actually, the publication of this book is, it feels, Dolores, like it's all timed with an opportunity for me to begin talking about some of this practice that has been sort of being formed over these almost 25 years now.
Yeah.
This,
what you were doing before, you were not talking about these sort of things?
Well, they sort of crept in, but, you know, there's the long history of, I guess, a lot of the spiritual masters was that, I mean, quite often they said to keep these things quiet and hold them close, and, you know, Jesus' admonishment to not let the right hand know what the left hand was doing, and many of the mystics telling us to not speak openly of these things. And so while it would creep in here and there, mostly, as my spiritual mentor told me recently, that he guessed that my time in seclusion was coming to an end and that I had some teaching to do now.
Okay.
And so this book titled Seeing True, 90 Contemplations in 90 Days, this Seeing True practice seems to be what is now being pulled forth. And as I think you probably know, Dolores, about all we can do is try and cooperate. Because I just as soon avoid getting hit by another one of those spiritual 2x4s.
Yeah, that's what I mean. They'll do it if you're not paying attention. But like you were saying, you know, we're supposed to hold it close and not speak of it. But I found it's because a lot of people don't understand, and we're not supposed to convert anybody. We're just, we'll put it out there, and if people are ready, they'll accept it.
Absolutely.
To make anybody believe anything.
Right, and one of the teachers I was working with up until a couple of years ago in Albuquerque, I'm from Albuquerque, New Mexico, and one of the teachers I was working with actually went back and pulled out some mystical literature and started pointing out how often they talk about metaphors like the flowers not needing to advertise. They just simply be flowers with their bouquet and with their brilliant colors, and they attract by virtue of that. And so there seems to be, you know, the Jesus' great line about not hiding your light under a basket. It's like we seem to attract rather than have to go out and promote these things, and it seems to take care of itself, I guess.
Yeah, because you seem to draw the people to you who need this anyway.
Exactly. I'm actually in Denver currently on tour with the book and a couple of other things, and I actually knew there was I met a woman yesterday at an event I did at Mile High Church here in Denver, and I knew we needed to talk some more today, but I didn't know what it was we needed to talk about. And so this afternoon we made some time and we got a chance to talk about some things that I didn't know I was going to be talking about, some of the underlying ideas of this Seeing True, and it was a very productive couple hours.
Uh-huh. Sometimes that's the way it happens, you know, you just run into somebody and the time is right.
Yeah, and you know, what's frustrating about that, Dolores, is it doesn't always come when I'm prepared for it.
Well, me either, you know, because I'm as a therapist, I see so many people.
Uh-huh.
And all of the stories that they have to tell and all of the problems. So there's all kinds of people out there, so as you well know, you're finding them too.
Right. And about all I know to do is to be prepared to talk about whatever it is that seems to need to be talked about.
Yeah. I was just in Albuquerque. I was teaching at the Northern New Mexico College there at Santa Fe.
Oh, yeah. How did that go?
Just 2 weeks ago. Yeah. And the only thing that bothered me was the altitude.
Oh, did it you have breathing problems?
Well, no, it was headaches and like yep. You feel a pressure, but I didn't feel comfortable. It took about 3 or 4 days to adjust. But then they said Albuquerque is 5,000 feet, and Santa Fe, where I was close to 8,000 feet. That's a big difference.
Right, and they actually say when you go to New Mexico, I guess the same thing is true all up and down the Rocky Mountains, is to avoid exercise and things for the first 48 hours because the oxygen uptake is not good enough, and so you end up with headaches and exactly what you're describing, altitude sickness,
yeah.
They might call it.
That's why I went in there a day or two ahead of time. I was at El Rito, if you know where that is.
I do. It's a small community tucked away in a beautiful little valley.
Mm-hmm. And it's the other campus for the Northern New Mexico College.
How did you find your way? How did you find your way to El Rito? That's a little off the beaten path.
Well, that's where they were having the class. And they took me up there, but they said they had two campuses, the one in Santa Fe and the one that was out there. And so all of the students got there. We had about 40 people. It was a big class. But I've told them before on the radio, before I went, this is the only college in the United States that is having a 4-year course in natural medicine and alternative healing. And they are teaching acupuncture, homeopathy, aromatherapy, all kinds of the natural things, and they wanted me to be a part of it. So that's why I'm teaching there now, and I'm going to be going back next semester. But they're giving a BS, a Bachelor of Science, in the natural healing. And I think this is really wonderful. They're a groundbreaker. It's the first ones to ever do it. And I have a feeling the other colleges will probably going to follow suit when they see this is the way things are going.
Well, there is a very long tradition, Dolores, as I'm sure you tripped across while you were there. There's a very long tradition of traditional healing in northern New Mexico,
yeah,
the curanderas, dating...
Indians.
The Indians and dating well back into the Hispanic culture, which is actually the largest, the longest culture in the United States, and so there's still a lot of people who use traditional preparations and traditional herbs, and in fact, I know a few people who still prescribe, well, if prescription is the right word, who still prepare them and provide them to their patients. So
yeah, I'm working with doctors all over the world now who are involved in the natural healing. And
mm-hmm.
my company has published the largest herbal encyclopedia that's ever been printed. So I'm very much involved in all of this. And that's why I lecture on it and travel and do all
mm-hmm.
of that. This is the way things are going. But I didn't mean to get off of what you were talking about, but I said I was just out in your neck of the woods anyway.
Yeah, well, it's a good neck of the woods to be in, Dolores.
Except for the altitude. And I missed my trees because where I live in Arkansas, it's green and beautiful.
Well, you're out in that's all high desert country, and it's pretty in its own right. It's just not at all like Arkansas.
No, every place is beautiful, and every place body lives in these places for their certain reasons. But I've got to have the woods and the trees. So when you come here for the conference, you're going to get to see what our neck of the woods is like anyway.
Well, actually, one of my favorite areas is the Ozarks. I've found the Buffalo River area is an area I've visited a number of times and find extraordinarily pretty.
Yeah, so you've got an idea that every place is different, but
mm-hmm.
this is where I come back. It's my retreat where I recharge my batteries when I'm not traveling. Go ahead and talk about the book then, because
okay.
you have had this background where you said you were searching and doing spiritual work and trying to find your answers, I guess. So what happened that really made you go over into this kind of work?
Well, the bottom line was that you know, when my life fell apart, literally, even on the physical level, a lot of medical problems related to that time. And when all that happened, I just couldn't keep living and doing what I was doing. And I came by a very, very good spiritual mentor. He's a fellow who lives now in Texas, down by Austin. And he began in the grand, you know, in the great tradition of spiritual tradition. He began to teach me, and we've been working together for a very long time now. And one of the things that led me into, the thing that most impressed me during that whole process, I learned a lot and I studied a lot, but the thing that impressed me more than anything else was the power of questioning, the power of inquiry. I actually had, and there's a reference in this book to a fellow by the name of Joe Bankhead, who passed away last year, but he used to travel all over the desert Southwest, and he and I were chatting one day about his wanderings and one of the, you know, what he'd found and all that. And he talked at length about the personal relationship we all end up having with the divine, that you know, Dolores, how I experience God, the divine, the universe, can't be the same as how you experience it. It is unique personal relationship with the divine. Yes. And so what became of great interest to me and what's represented in the book is the process where we begin to find that I can't simply adopt what you believe. It won't work for me like it works for you. So I have no choice but to start asking questions for myself about how will it work for me. And so the book, and I actually wrote a book before it that was more secular, it wasn't spiritual in nature, is a workbook format, and it invites people to ask questions about how this deal works so that they can build their own understanding, to build their own spiritual capacities in areas that they may not have them in. I'm sorry, go ahead.
You said to make them think for themselves.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I call it non-directive learning, where what I do is I do a lot of this work with individuals and in spiritual communities, and actually even in the professional work that I do, is you give people an opportunity to see things in a certain light, and then you give them the opportunity to begin to ask questions about it, because apparently, Dolores, the most powerful thing you and I have available to us is the ability to ask questions.
Yes, and you know, I don't want to have anything against churches. I mean, I figure people should believe what they believe, but the churches always say, don't ask questions. Just accept what we say. And I've always asked questions. I've always wanted to know more, and they don't like that.
it's funny you should say that, because what actually, when I first began my path, I ended up in a fairly conventional community church, evangelical Christian church. And I had a series of events that didn't make sense according to what I was being taught. And so I went to one of the elders, because I have an insatiable need to understand. And so I went to one of the elders, and I started asking questions about this, and I got what were obviously some stock answers. And so I had to reject it all and had to go start finding my own answers. And you're right, there wasn't any tolerance for me questioning the dogma. But this idea that Joe Bankhead had shared, the fellow I mentioned just a little while ago, that the idea that he had shared that every single one of us must necessarily have our own separate and unique experience of God, the universe, how it works, just makes perfectly good sense to me, because everybody I've talked to over the years, Dolores, they all have a little different reality about it than I do. And so
everyone
it makes perfectly good
reality. That's the thing. And we can't say one is right and one is wrong.
Right. No more than we could say that, I mean, you know, I talk a lot with your daughter, Julia, and no more than it makes perfectly good sense that my relationship with you would be different from Julia's relationship with you. That it would be absolutely unique to each of us. And that doesn't mean that my relationship with you is wrong and Julia's is right. It means the nature of personal relationship is unique. And so, absolutely. And there's something, there's something very, very powerful in that, to understand that we get to create it and experience it in our own unique way, that we don't have to, we don't have to do it the way other people do it.
Well, that's what I try to tell people. There's no right and there's no wrong. It's all in the way you understand it, and the way your understanding is at that time. It can always change later, too. As you grow and you mature, you go off in other directions. So where you are in your stage of development, I see you where you're supposed to be. And that way you shouldn't tell someone, you know, they're not doing it right, that you should change it, because they're where they're supposed to be at that time.
Well, and don't you suppose, Dolores, that one of the great spiritual consistencies across all the religions, all the traditions, is about love. And everybody sooner or later talks about love being without condition. And that should mean that our only response to people wherever they are and with whatever they're practicing is we just love them.
Yep, that's what I tell in my lectures and my book, that love is the answer to everything. If there was love in the world, there would be no violence, there would be no wars. It would solve everything, but it's, you know, people just can't see it that way. But it is the answer to everything.
And so we're given this great opportunity each time we encounter someone who has a different perspective, a different belief, a different experience of God. We're offered this opportunity every single time to just love them and love exactly what they believe, because that's what they believe. That's where they're at. They couldn't be doing it any other way.
And we're not supposed to try to change them. That is where they're at, that stage of their life.
Absolutely. There's a writing in this book that talks about the nature of innocence. And part of what it says is you just have to understand that everybody's waking up this morning doing the very best they know how. And you love them anyway. Because nobody is doing any different than they know or understand today, just like you were saying, Dolores.
Mm-hmm.
I
was in church, you know, I used to teach Sunday school and the whole thing, and I would sit there and listen to the sermons, and I kept wanting to raise my hand and say, but maybe it means this instead. And I don't know, you know. But I always questioned everything. I'd go to the pastor and ask questions, and they usually say, well, it's not for us to know.
Uh-huh.
When you die, you'll have all the answers. There's a scoreboard up there somewhere, and you'll know why. But I said, I don't want to wait that long. I want to know now.
You must have been their favorite.
That's why eventually I had to leave the church, because I had too many questions that weren't being answered. It's the same thing.
I completely understand, and I can only imagine that you drove them crazy with your questions.
Yeah, so I eventually, they was glad to see me leave, I think, because I made them think, and they weren't comfortable with that.
Sure. Sure. Well, and yet it seems like I've had a number of people suggest to me that I shouldn't think as much as I think, and that I shouldn't feel as much as I feel, and I shouldn't ask the questions I ask. And yet my usual answer to them, Dolores, is it's like, I mean, this is the way I was made. That this is how I am. Is I got this brain that works this way, and I got these questions that come up. And I have to honor that. That's me. To honor what was created, I got to be consistent with it. And so if that makes some other people uncomfortable, I guess that's just how it's going to have to be.
Well, see, I've written 15 books now, and I have so many questions. I've got such a terrible, is a word, I guess, terrible curiosity. I want to know it all. But the people that read the book said, we want to know, too, and you're finding out the answers we need. So there are people like us that are meant to go against the mold, I guess, just to be curious and want to have the answers.
Now, do you find, Dolores, that a lot of those people are then, as a result of your questioning, able to undertake their own questioning?
Yes, they said it makes them think.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of my experience as well, is that when people are given permission by our behavior and by our questioning, it's like they have their own opportunity to do that for themselves. And it ends up opening doors of understanding, and goodness knows there's an awful lot to understand.
Oh, definitely. And we're never going to know it all, but at least we can take our baby steps to try anyway.
And that's why I think the whole questioning process is so greatly, and yet it's so funny, because the thing I see about, you know, the way we humans seem to operate is that we so often, Dolores, we don't want to ask the questions. Is that your experience? People want someone, so often we want someone to give us the answers rather than to go in search of for ourselves. I guess I don't know why that is, but it seems like that's the way we are.
I guess, but I'm always the one asking the questions.
Me too.
I want to know everything, and that's a big order to know everything.
Well,
we won't ever know everything anyway, but at least I've tried. It's a big goal. But, you know, whenever you're doing the other work, you also, as a motivational speaker, what do you do in that type of work?
Well, it kind of depends on my audience. One of the, and this will make perfectly good sense to you and our listeners as well, is one of the great things I came by is that as a speaker, my first obligation is to try and meet the audience's needs.
Yeah.
If they are there to hear about metaphysics, then I need to talk about metaphysics. If they are there to hear about, you know, like in other cases, I do some teaching of public speaking skills. If they're there to learn public speaking skills, I need to make sure and try and provide that for them because that's what they're there for. And the interesting balancing act for me has been, because sometimes, as I'm sure you well know from your own speaking work, sometimes things come up that need to be said that you weren't planning on.
Oh, yeah.
And you do have to figure out how to put those in there too, but you got to keep remembering what the audience needs. So my number one strategy is to try and give the audience what they need. My second strategy with speaking, and I talk about a number of subjects depending upon what audiences I'm talking to. My second great strategy is to be as honest as I can be. Which what I've learned about that is, that's such a hard thing for us to do at times, because when you have an audience, there's a tendency to feel like we can't be as honest about who we are, especially about our failings. You know, the people look up to you when you're on a stage or when you got a microphone on or when you're dressed up. And
yeah.
And one of the great things I've learned is I'm just going to have to keep telling the truth about myself, about what I'm thinking, even if it doesn't look good. Go ahead.
I do the same thing, because I always give my background. And, you know, tell them that, you know, we none of us had an easy way to get where we are.
Mm-hmm.
We all had obstacles. We all had things we had to overcome. And I think they can identify with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, one of my most effective closes when I do some of the professional speaking that I do is when I get to the end, Dolores, what I make sure and do is I say, I need to tell you all, I know I sounded good, I know I looked good, I'm a professional at this, you need to understand some things about me, and I'll start telling them some of the things about my life falling apart and alcoholism and some of the challenges I faced.
Oh.
And the reason I'll always do that is because you need to, the tendency when you see someone speak well on a stage who looks good and all that, the tendency is to think that you're not like them. That they had it easier, or they didn't have the struggles that you have. And so what I try and do with that is, at the end, I try and just let people know who I really am, because they need to know that if I've overcome these challenges, they can overcome theirs too. That that there's nothing special about me.
That's what I tell them. I said, if I can do what I have done, overcome what I have done, then anybody can do anything.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really realize what it took to get to this point. I had a woman, I think it was in Santa Fe, and maybe it was in Atlanta last week. She said, we have a tendency to see people where they are now, you know, the height they have reached.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, people think, oh, looks easy, I could do that. But she said they don't realize all the years it took to get to that point. You know, all the years and all the heartbreak and all the things you had to overcome. And they don't realize what it takes to get to that point. They just see that and they say, well, that's what I want. But, you know, it's like with these movie stars, one of them said one time, oh, yeah, they say I'm an overnight sensation. Yes, it took 20 years to become an overnight sensation. They
absolutely
don't realize you have to work to get to anything.
And what is so funny about that, for me, is, because like I mean, I speak pretty well, and I look pretty good when I get on the stage and when I do my, you know, workshops or speeches or whatever I do. And exactly what you're talking about is what happens. I get up there, and if I'm in some audiences, it's appropriate for me to be dressed in a suit, and it really depends on the audience. But what I see happen is exactly that, Dolores. They look at me, they listen to me, and they assume I've always been this way.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Exactly. Not knowing that there was a time when there were a great deal of struggles going on, and I know we do the same thing with, it's kind of like, okay, well, I mean, until I listen to you talk enough, Dolores, the only reality I've got is the one I have of you right now. So I got to keep listening to you and keep opening myself up to hear your whole story so I can get the bigger picture of you. And,
yeah.
And know, as you say, that you didn't, you know, I mean, you I don't know how many hours you had to put into writing your 15 books. But they did not just write themselves. You didn't come prepackaged with 15 books ready to do.
And that's like I tell people, that's like I said, there's a lot of heartache along the way, a lot of disappointments, a lot of problems that they don't see when they're looking at the end results.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely true. And as you well know, some of our listeners, I'm sure, are authors, and many of them may not be. One of the greatest disappointments as a writer is when you write things that don't turn out well, or they get rejected, or they're not well received. It takes a lot of courage, which I guess is a recipe for life. It takes a lot of courage to keep coming back and trying again.
Yeah, that's what I say. Been there, done that. Because I tell people, I had absolutely everything that could happen to a writer happened to me, so I know what it's like to just keep going in spite of it.
Mm-hmm.
When I speak at writers' conferences, I said, if you believe in what you're doing and keep at it, eventually somebody else will believe in you too. But if you give up, you'll never know what you can attain.
I remember some of the work I did involved small businesses, and the thing that they used to talk about there, Dolores, was that the number one cause of failure is not continuing.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, boy, that sounds far too simple, but it's so true, is that the number one thing we can do to create success is to persist.
Yes, in spite of everything, no matter what's happening, because like I said, there were times I wanted to throw everything against the wall and just quit because I said it hurts too much. Because it took me 9 years to find my first publisher, and I went through so much. But then I sat down and I said, okay, I can quit, but what else do I want to do?
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to do anything but write. So in spite of everything and all of the rejections and all of the heartache, I sat down and wrote another book.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you want it bad enough, you'll keep at it. And that's what I tell them. If you quit, you will never know. You know, you think you failed, but you'll never know if you quit.
And didn't that...
What do they want to accomplish? You know?
And didn't that failure, didn't that challenge, I mean, I can only imagine in those 9 years that
yeah.
in addition to learning how to persevere, I can only imagine that whole process increased your skills in, well, probably communicating. Did you have to do a bunch of rewriting of that first book?
Oh, the first book, no.
Okay.
No, they writing came easy. It was finding somebody who would publish it, because I was back before the days of the New Age stores and all of
mm-hmm.
that, New Age publishers. I was doing it before there was anything out there that would buy it. That was the problem. And I had a lot of people telling me I couldn't do it, and I had no support. So there, you know, there's a lot of obstacles you have to overcome, but you got to believe in yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That's the main thing. If you believe in yourself, somebody else will believe in you also.
And one of the things I learned along the way, which is a very valuable one that I love to talk about, is how when you understand that obstacles are part of the design. That
yeah,
our mamas taught us this when they, well, maybe our daddies, when they said, somewhere along the way, when somebody somewhere said, you know, nothing good ever came easy, honey.
Yeah.
And difficulty, obstacles, challenges are part of the design. We grow by encountering them and overcoming them. That's part of the way this universe is designed, is resistance, gravity, friction, all the things that we have to work to overcome is part of the natural design of things.
Because, you know, if something is just handed to you, you don't have to work for it, you never appreciate it. It's
mm-hmm.
just like these movie stars, you know, comes too easy, then they end up on, you know, dope addicts and their whole career falls apart because
mm-hmm.
it was too easy. They just got it handed to them. They didn't have to work for it. You know, I've read where some movie star would say the first car that he had to work for and save for and maybe put together meant more to him than any of the big cars he had now that he was famous.
Mm.
Because he had to earn it. He had to work for it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was easier because I mean, makes more sense, because if something's just handed to you without the obstacles, you're not going to appreciate it. But I can remember way back, I think it was only about the first or second grade in school, I said something to the teacher about, this is not easy. And the teacher told me something I'll never forget, and she said, if it's easy, it's not worth doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never forgot that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we so much of, when I look back upon what has brought me to this point, I'm 51 now, which is not that old, but there's still been a lot of adversity I've had to overcome.
Yeah.
And I have learned a tremendous amount as a result of that. Some of the things I'm able to do today, I could never have learned how to do were it not for the difficulties encountered.
Yes.
Uh-huh. It's made me, I once wrote this item where I talked about how, you know, to really take credit for who I am is false, because who I am is not only the product of all the people who contributed to me. I mean, everything from my parents and the genes that made me up to the teachers.
The biological part.
All that stuff. And what made me also was the many, many things I have failed at. That you can't ignore those things in terms of what part they've played in making each of us who we are.
Mm-hmm.
Even the ones that have left some of us with bad bumps and bruises and missing fingers, and I'm not one of those, but I mean, I know a lot of people have paid some terrible physical prices for you know, the hardships they've encountered, and yet some of the most remarkable people I've met in this journey have been people who've had terrible prices they've had to pay.
Oh yeah.
In fact, I was just talking with a mutual friend, Nancy Lee, who I think I've hooked you and her up so y'all can talk, and she interviewed you a number of years ago, I know, and she and I were just having this conversation yesterday about about how much the challenges have made us who we are. Mm-hmm. And I completely understand that. I'm a much more interesting and marvelous person as a result of all the nicks I've got in myself from all those misadventures.
But see, you know, as a therapist, that's the first thing I do when I have a client.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say, tell me about yourself. Tell me about your life.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I don't know anything about you, I won't even know the questions to ask.
Mm-hmm.
And I stay with them for long enough that they'll begin telling me all of the problems and all the things they've had to overcome.
Mm-hmm.
And I know their upbringing, their childhood, because I said, that's what makes you who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard horror stories people wouldn't believe, that I always wondered, how did this person ever become a functioning adult from the way they were raised?
Mm-hmm.
But it's just credit that they have persevered and become a functioning adult. So I see all kinds of problem cases. But that's what I do, you know, try to help people with my mm-hmm. work anyway.
Well, and I don't know, I had one of the guys I reference in my book, a guy by the name of Jim Peterson, who had a horrible story of surviving D-Day, the beaches of Normandy, and his descent into insanity, and it was just, I mean, it's a pretty awful story, but his take home from all of that, he died a few years ago, but this would have been, he was in his 80s when he was talking about this. What he used to say, Dolores, was he used to say, cuddle up to your fear and your pain. Make them your friend because they have things to teach you.
Okay.
And it took him, you know, all those many years to understand that just as all the things that are wonderful are things to embrace, so too are all the things that are challenges, that they're all part of this wonderful thing called life that we get to figure out what to do with. And you don't get to accept only some of them and reject the rest. Life is offered as life, and you take it all because that's how it is.
Yes, when people tell me about their problems, that's what I say. That's life.
Mm-hmm.
It's all part of it. It's how you overcome them and how you deal with them and handle them.
Mm-hmm.
It's how it all fits together, you know.
Well,
Do you have any other examples that are in the book that you want to share?
Well, I was actually thinking about that. There is one I love to do when I have an audience. It's a piece called Greatness. Doesn't look like we have time for me to read it, but people can.
Well, we've got a little time. I'll have to stop in five minutes.
You want me to give it a shot then? Well, let me read Greatness, and people will get a feel for kind of how this book works.
In the book, they're only one page long, aren't they?
Right, they're one pagers, and then there's a page for you to journal, because journaling seems to be so important. And so this is actually a fairly short one. It's entitled Greatness. Tears creep into my eyes as I consider the tale of my greatest achievement. It came as my second wife and I worked out the terms of our divorce. Natalie and Brianne, my stepdaughters, wanted to know how my split from their mom would affect them. I told the girls, my daughters, that I had come to love them and I had made commitments to them. The fact that their mother and I were splitting would have no bearing on anything. Nothing would change. They were skeptical, but they appreciated my reassurance. What they didn't know was that I had had many discussions with trusted friends on this. I had concluded that love was a principle and demonstration was its proof. 5 years have passed at the time of this writing, and my actions have exceeded my highest expectations. As a result, I have two daughters who love me very much. I can describe any number of occasions where I've fallen short in so many ways in my life, but in this one place, I have risen to a level I never dreamed possible. I'm humbled by the telling of my experience of greatness. It is greatness for which spirit's credit must be acknowledged, but it is mine to relish. And then on the second page, on the other page, I ask these simple questions for the reader. What is my moment of greatness? What or who made it possible, and how does it make me feel? And the reason I like to use this one, Dolores, is because one of the funniest things in the world, and I know you know this because of your therapy practice, one of the funniest things about this world of ours is the last thing in the world that we feel like we can talk about is the things that we have done very, very well. We can ridicule ourselves, we can talk about all the things we've done wrong, but we're thought to be proud and boastful if we talk honestly about the things we've done well. And my goodness, I mean, all of us have done some things right. But we're not encouraged to talk about those. And so with an audience, I oftentimes will use this one, and I will say, okay, so somebody stand up and tell me about your moment of greatness. And my goodness, everybody gets so shy at that moment because everybody's so embarrassed to talk about something we've done really well, which is exactly why I ask them to do that.
Well, they always think it's ego coming in. You know?
Right. Right. And yet, to tell the truth about something we have done well is just as humble as to tell the truth about something we've done poorly.
Definitely.
I'm
not watching the clock, but Ron, tell them, can you have a website or email if people want to contact you?
Absolutely. The website is www.magneticnorthllc.com. That's magneticnorthllc.com.
That is all in one word?
It's one word, and that's the name of my company.
Magnetic North LLC?
LLC.com.
.com. It's all in one word.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And I do want to tell everybody that we are having our third transformational conference here in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and that's the weekend of June the 13th through the 15th, Friday through Sunday. And we're going to have a lot of very very good speakers. And Ron is going to be there. He's going to start the whole conference off on Friday. And so you'll have a little taste of him tonight, but he'll be telling a whole lot more on Friday. So I know we're looking forward to having you there, Ron.
I'm delighted to come in, and even more pleased to be the lead-off speaker. That's going to be a lot of fun for me.
Okay, and the name of his book is Seeing True, and that's the way we have it. You have the subtitle is 90 Contemplations.
Yeah, 90 Contemplations in 90 Days, and the title is Seeing True.
And it's very easy to read because each page has a different thing to make you think about. That way you can start anywhere in the book, really. And just that one page, and then, like he said, on the opposite page, you can journal, you can write what your reactions are.
Yeah, and my friends tell me that the best way to use it is to set it on your nightstand and pick it up and see what page falls open and to presume that that's God's direction for you for that day.
Okay. That's rather like the Unity Church with their word for the day.
Exactly. And I figure, since I didn't write it, I mean, quite honestly, it wasn't written that necessarily you would go from front to back. I just think it's important for people to get in the habit of contemplating because it's such an important part of our spiritual growth.
Making them think. Yeah, because that's a very easy book to read, and it's a very important truth in there for people to read and contemplate. Okay, so we're reaching the end of the time here now. But the name of the book is Seeing True, and you can find it if you can't get it through your bookstores, you can have them order it through the bookstores. They can find it. It is in their computers. A lot of times they will tell people, well, the book's not in print or it's out of print because they don't want to look it up in their computers. But you can get any of the books that we publish. And the name of our company is Ozark Mountain Publishing, and our website is www.ozarkmt.com. mountainbookshop.com, the abbreviation for mountain. And all of the books we publish are on there, and all the information about the conference is also on there if you want to check it out. And it's very reasonable for the 3 days, and we're going to be here at Fayetteville, Arkansas at the Clarion Hotel. And it's not going to be very much longer now. And our 800 number, if you want to call, is 1-800-935-0045 if you want any more information. And next week, I've got to go to Newark, New Jersey. I've got a class I'm going to do up there. So it's going to be a couple of weeks now before I'll be back on again live, and then I'll be getting ready for the conference and talking more about the other speakers. But thanks, everybody, for looking in tonight, and I thank you, Ron, for being our guest.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Dolores. I'm looking forward to Fayetteville in a few weeks.
Okay, so we'll say goodnight to everybody.
Good night.
And we'll have one of the archive shows next week then. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.